Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Will, how are you, dude? It's Matt Stocks.
Hey, Matt, how you doing, dude? I'm not too bad at all. I'm a little hungover today because we had a few drinks last night on the eve of this record coming out.
Well, I just spoke to my good friend, our mutual friend, Jack Hutchcraft, because I'm back in London, and I was seeing if he was around to hang out, and he's like, "Oh, I'm just on a train coming back from Manchester. I've been having a release party with the Creeper guys." He said you had a good time.
Yeah, it was one of those nights that it just never ends, you know?
I know them all too well, especially during lockdown. Like, it seems like because there's no last orders or closing time, the night spills over into the next day.
That's exactly it. There's no rules anymore, is there? And that's the thing with Jack, you know, you go out with Jack and then this is what sort of mischief happens, unfortunately. And so it was good fun. It's just one of those days where it's all been a lot. And obviously because it's release day, my phone began ringing super early for my manager asking for things.
I'll bet, yeah.
Was not up to it.
Well, thanks for giving up your time today. I would have thought you would have been celebrating tonight, but I presume you probably are celebrating tonight as well.
Well, this is going to be it. I think my our friend is back in town tonight, so I don't know if I can do it again, though. I'm getting a bit too old to do two in a row, you know, like the really heavy ones. I could drink consistently across a week, but like the big binge drinking nights, they get a bit too much for me these days.
Well, I find as well that, you know, you get into like almost 3 day hangovers at this stage in life as well. And then you're wasting half the week just kind of, you know, hovering up in a ball going, why did I do it to myself?
I know, exactly. You're trying to recover. That's the main thing, isn't it? I have to take paracetamol before I go to sleep now. That's the trick I've learned. Even if I haven't got the headache now, because I know it's going to come in the night, you know.
Oh, you get ahead of the curve.
Exactly. I'm trying to jump ahead of myself. That's a special move. That's my two special moves. A pint of water before bed and some paracetamol, even if you haven't got a headache.
Well, you sound surprisingly chipper. I must say, when I spoke to Jack, I was expecting a hello. You sound bang on it, mate. And we've got a lot to talk about. And you've had a lot to celebrate. So fair play to you. It's much deserved.
Well, thanks very much, man. It's been a weird couple of years. It all kind of culminated in this release of this album yesterday. Well, this morning,
yeah, today as we talk. I mean, I wonder if we could backtrack. You've probably been asked about it a bit, so apologies if we're going over trodden ground, but you know, the kind of the Coco show that you guys do where you put to bed Creeper then and there, at that point in time, did you know leading up to that show that that was going to be a significant show in advance?
Well, yeah, the thing about that show is it's kind of become something like it's kind of embedded in the Creeper lore now, that show, because it's such an important, it ended up being far more significant than we'd realised, because that was the last, not only, like, it was all theatre, of course. I planned it for you know, a couple of years in advance. But at the end of the campaign, doing this thing on stage, aping the Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars breakup at the Hammersmith back in the 70s, you know, where he split the band up on stage.
Of course. So you knew going into that gig that was going to be one of those moments where it was going to be a full stop on that era of the band. That was something you were all conscious of and actively going for.
Yeah. But it's weird, though. Like, as so often with these things, Creeper often... the Creeper's not like a band, really. It's like... I can't really explain it to you another way. It's kind of like a... It's like performance art, a lot of it is. The music is obviously a big part of that. But, like, I think people... if you compare us to other bands, we seem ludicrous. It seems silly. Because we're not just six people in a room bashing songs out and then walking on the stage and playing the songs. It's all this other silliness that comes along with it. But what we try and do is meld the fiction and reality together to create this kind of almost like what professional wrestling is. What's real and what's fake is all kind of drift together.
Well, it's a self-contained universe, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. It's these things exist in their own place, you know, and it's about performing, because when you get these things right, like when it's done right, we don't always get there, but when we do it right, it presents like a really like a three-dimensional place that our listeners can go and escape to. So if they go to a show, they know they're going to see something larger than life, where they can dress however they want, be whoever they want to be. And if they're having a hard time with work or at school, you put one of these records on your way home, and the idea is that you can kind of disappear into that world for a while. So it's really important to us to constantly maintain and protect this universe that we create. So that show, there was obviously this fictional element of it. There was an element of kind of a theatre to the whole thing, but it was the killing of the old band. Of course, we're never going to wear those jackets again. It's never going to be the end of that era. It had come and gone there. But the week after that, the reality is so often happens to these things. Like kind of life begins imitating art, and our band almost really did break up just after that, because within that week, I had a death in my family on the Sunday, and on the Monday, Ian Miles was sectioned with out of his, I guess it's quite well publicised now, he had a major psychotic episode in Southampton, and he had to be taken away. And then I began this kind of process of trying to keep things together and going out to Los Angeles on my own for months and months. So we ended this really, really big period of darkness, all while we were on a social media blackout, which was self-imposed. But we didn't want to break the illusion of what was going on to tell everybody that this we might have to, you know, that we didn't want to tell everybody what was going on, because we try and protect what we do for people, this universe. We didn't want anyone to tamper with that. We didn't want reality to mess up our vision, you know. So we entered a very, very, very dark place for quite some time. And it's funny, that show, yes, it was definitely pre-planned. It definitely was a big piece of performance art. But at the same time, it really was the last time our band, until now, it was the last time our band was actually functioning and working. It really was the death in a way. And this rebirth has been much more of a real life rebirth rather than a press angle. You know, it's not like, you know, sometimes you see that stuff and it's like,
of course,
they're back from the dead. But this is kind of quite literally almost that. Very, very strange time. It was kind of a bit of both, if that makes sense.
Yeah, man. I mean, I know it's a day of celebration and I don't want to go anywhere where, you know, you're uncomfortable going. I don't want to bum you out on your release day either. But you mentioned the death in the family there. I was reading that was your mum's partner, right? And then the next day, literally the next day, was when Ian had to go off and, you know, take care of himself and do what he needed to do to get right. I mean, how, when you're on this come down from the project and this era of the band anyway, because I know that things like that come with this great come down, like the lows are low, aren't they? After those ultimate highs, you do come crashing down. To then have those two things as well, I mean, how did you personally deal with it? How did you navigate those really difficult days, if you don't mind getting into it?
No, I think the thing is about this stuff, we decided that we were going to talk about the mental health stuff. Ian wanted to talk about it, and I think it's important we talk about hardships, because I think sometimes the lifestyle of a musician is glamorized to some extent and people don't really know fully what goes on. The problem is with me is I'm always really focused on what we're doing next every single time. So I'm constantly thinking about what we're putting out and plotting ahead. That's how like that show happened, because we had 2 years in advance to get to that point. You know, it's like a workout steps that we need to get to a point where we can do that gig, which it involves a lot of planning. So when something like this happens, it and I had to carry on. I didn't have a chance really to
grieve,
to reflect, yeah. or anything. I we had to go. I was supposed to fly out with Ian Miles on the Friday to Los Angeles, and on the Sunday that horrible thing happened to my mum, and on the Monday the horrible thing happened to Ian, and Ian was kind of stripped from me, he was taken away in a very dramatic fashion. In the center of Southampton, there's that podcast online at the moment that kind of, he goes into quite some depth on it, and I won't really tell his story for him, but if you're ever interested, it's called Sex, Death and the Infinite Void, the story of Sex, Death and the Infinite Void, that's what it's called.
Podcast that you guys put out yourselves, or was he a guest on someone else's, what was that, so people can...
it's actually really interesting, this. So my friend Giles, do you know Giles? You might know Giles.
I don't know.
In Great Cynics, if you know that band.
Right.
I've known him just from punk rock since I was a kid, you know. Shows, all our old bands and things. He had me on his podcast, 101 Part-Time Jobs, which is a podcast where he talks about what you did, what some musicians currently do for a living to support their music, and what people who, you know, he was asking me about jobs I did when I was a kid, when I first started touring and stuff, and it was really fun, just kind of just telling him some weird old stories. And then midway through the article, a little bit about the Creeper record, I guess to try and plug it a little bit in the podcast. And I told him a very brief overview. And he called me. He called me just a tiny bit later. He said, "Will, how do you feel about me making an audio documentary about this?" And I really didn't want to tell him the story because there was so much that's gone on during the course of this record. That it felt really unnerving, but we kind of he chased it. He was very persistent with it, and in the end, he we started letting him do interviews. And it was first of all, it was just going to be just with me, and I felt like if it was just with me, I kind of had some control over it, and I could protect everybody I needed to protect. And because we thought it was a good piece of content as well, you know, at first that's kind of what you're like, well, this is cool. It'd be something people could learn a little bit about the record.
Yeah, of course, like a behind-the-scenes making-of featurette kind of thing.
Exactly, yeah. So I thought, like, you know, I probably wouldn't mention anything that had really happened. I'd tell as much as I wanted to tell. But Giles is a fantastic journalist, and he knows us very well. And so he ended up putting us at ease numerous times. And he ended up kind of doing like a Louis Theroux, almost, he kind of put us at ease so much that we were more honest than we would ever have been, to the point where, like, he ended up getting interviews with Sandy Barry, our producer in Hollywood, our manager, our record label, loads of different people, basically, really, really involved, who wouldn't normally do this sort of thing. But I think everyone trusted Giles so much. And Ian agreed, in the end, to speak about what happened to him in quite some candid detail, and that day when he got sectioned, and my involvement in that as well, and so it's over five parts. It's called Creeper, the story of Sex, Death, and the Infinite Void, and it's by Mighty Moon Media. But it's basically not produced by the band. It's a podcast about the band, and we are interviewed in it. It's a lot more honest because it hasn't been made by a PR company, it hasn't been made by a company, it hasn't been made by a band. It's just a guy
trying to get the truth,
a lot of
people.
It should come with a massive trigger warning. When we've been promoting it, we've been talking about it having a massive trigger warning because there is some really, really difficult stuff in there about mental health. That was what was going on. In answer to your question, I've got a really long way around answering your question here.
There's no need for short answers on this show. It's all good, man. We're just chatting.
When that happened to Ian, I had spoken to his wife a lot as he was taken away, and I didn't know what to do. And in the end, we basically it got to the point where it was like, well, I felt like we should put everything on hiatus. That's what I wanted to do. But it basically would have meant that by the time he would have come round, if we'd have waited for him to recover, gone right through recovery, could have been a year, and it probably would have been until his full recovery. And so by that time, you know, we'd have been 3 years away from where we when we put the last record out, and we'd still be starting this record. It would have basically lost everything, and then him being taken away would have cost him. It would have cost him so much more than it already had. You know, it would have cost him his band, his creativity, his livelihood, all he's worked for. So I basically made a decision with his wife to go out to Los Angeles on my own. I had to get the plane on my own, and it was a seat next to me where he was supposed to be. It was really weird. It was horrible. And
it's a beautiful thing that you made that choice, because I know it must have been so hard going forward without him, because I remember interviewing you guys years ago when Creeper was just getting started for Scuzz, and without taking anything away from the rest of the band, you two are very much kind of like the creative partners at the center of that world, aren't you? And he's your right-hand man.
Yeah, well, this is kind of it. We started this band together. It was we've been playing in bands together for years before that as well. He's just like, you know, for this sort of what we do with this, like we are kind of a duo, you know, in that regard. And
he's your brother in life.
Yeah, exactly. We've done everything together. You know, we travel the world together. I'm looking at a picture on my wall right now of me, Ian, and Jerry Only.
Amazing. <missed
it. laughs> It's really cool. It's funny, you know, when you're talking about something and you look up and it's just there. But yes, it was really, really weird. I went, my life was spiraling out of control as well. I was going through all sorts of stuff in my personal life too, the breakdown of my relationship and things. And so all this was going on, and I became a real anxious mess. But we're just trying to keep going, keep creative. But it's so hard to focus on this second follow-up to a record. Like I Sent It In Your Arms, which we were very lucky with, and people it was received so nicely, and we managed to achieve quite a lot from it, and tour the world.
A lot of pressure, right? Both from outside and on yourself.
Yeah, it was just the thing, and like, you know, I also am always at the forefront of my mind is my audience. I don't really care about like how it's reviewed so much as have we done our job in providing the escape that we needed when we were kids. That's why we found music. Have we done a good job doing that with our art for our audience? So that's at the front of my mind. But like, it was so difficult to create at first without Ian, with all this with kind of our whole lives on fire the hot entire time, and not knowing when he was going to get better. I was calling him every day from the hospital, the Priory. He was in the Priory in Brighton, and I was calling him every day. He was there for a month, I think, I would call him and we would chat, and he would tell me he would tell me all, he was still believing in this this conspiracy. He has spoken about it in press and print now as well, so I feel like I can talk about it a bit more, but he's still very much believing this elaborate conspiracy. But I carried on a lot of guilt for a long time as well, because I probably should have seen some of this stuff coming, but there was so much going on that we were writing together every day,
yeah.
And there were little weird, like kind of eccentric things he would do, but it didn't twig. And so I carried around an incredible amount of guilt. I had to call the police on my best friend. You know, they tried to dispatch an anti-terror unit to take him down. Basically, it was a really, really intense, mad thing. And I can't explain to you any more than that, really. I guess it's like hearing him talk about it in the podcast is probably the best way to find out more about that. But it was a really insane thing. So I was carrying around, I was guilt about having to call. I had to call people to take him away. And it was really, really traumatic. And then on the Friday, I'm going to Los Angeles on my own. So then my drinking just spiraled out of control, which is something I have battled with in the past. But it was really, really bad. Both my parents were quite worried about me. And but you know what? There became a moment when, in amongst all the chaos, this is kind of how we pieced together this record. This is kind of how it all came. We wrote about 50 songs for this record, and you got to remember, like, me and Ian have been going to Los Angeles long before working on this, long before that November 1st show. We'd already been going out there a lot, meeting people, trying to work out what we're going to do, where we take the sound to, what sort of songs we'd write. And so yeah, we were working all that for quite some time already. So when things were at a real particularly dark place, and you kind of felt like you had nothing left to lose, and you're like, well, you know what, if all goes up in flames, let's just make sure today we write something cool. That's really fun. And that kind of like, you know, that kind of frivolous nature that you have at that sort of point when it's really, really dark, that actually inspired some of the better moments, I think, on the record, which is a weird one, isn't it? Why is that? And why is it so commonly the case that that darkness inspires the best art? I don't know why that is, and it's probably quite unhealthy, but it did in our case.
It's interesting, all these things you're saying to me, Will. I'm no stranger to like paranoid, manic, psychotic episodes because my mum's bipolar. So I grew up visiting her in psych wards as a common thing. And so that's been around, that world and that kind of process of seeing someone that you love go to that place and seeing them. Did you get to see Ian in hospital, or were you in LA for the whole duration? But either or, you're still talking on the phone, and so I know exactly how difficult it is to communicate and engage and see somebody that you love in that place.
It's so weird, isn't it, going into those places. I had no idea about your mother. I'm sorry to hear that. It must have been difficult for you growing up. It's certainly strange, isn't it? Going into those places, I went to see him before I went to Los Angeles the first time. Yeah. That week, I went in on the Friday, I think. But those places are strange, aren't they? I guess you have experience in that as well. You can vouch for that they are odd places, because you're meeting people that sometimes seem completely alert and in the room, and then the next moment can be in quite a different place. And so I was worried about him so much, but I think he ended up having quite a strange experience there, quite a strange time. It's difficult, man, isn't it? The whole thing is just it's hard. And now I feel like we can kind of talk about it with some sort of hindsight now, which is cool. But for a long time, I was FaceTiming him to write songs with him, or while his wife brought a guitar into his hospital room, and he would sit there on the phone while believing all this conspiracy still, but kind of managed to kind of compartmentalize that part of his brain, that part of his brain, and kind of switch that bit off for a second to pick up and help write a chord or something over FaceTime, and while I was in Los Angeles and he was in Brighton in the Priory. Isn't that crazy? And I would call him every day. He's starting to remember more of that stuff now, which is cool.
Yeah, my mum describes it as like kind of blackout episodes. Like if you're drunk, like you're doing all this stuff and saying all this stuff, but then you don't necessarily remember it when you come down from that high. And then over time you get flashbacks and you piece together the puzzle a little bit more. I mean, what a testament to not just Ian's creativity, but to creativity as well. And there does seem to be a weird link sometimes between creative minds and unstable minds. And sometimes, as you were saying earlier, this great, sometimes very dark but also profound art is often born in these, you know, whirlwinds of chaos and pain, and it's clearly fed into this record. I mean, are there any songs on this album that are difficult for you to listen to because of the memories that come back from writing them, or indeed just what they're about?
It's the last one really that's the hard one.
All My Friends, is that
All My Friends? Yeah, that was a song I wrote for Ian. It was one of those songs that kind of spills out of you. Sometimes you're writing because you're required to write songs. Like, it sounds a lot more kind of mundane than that is, but just in the sense of, oh, today we're writing some songs. Ian's come over with his guitar. We're going to write some songs today. What will we write? You know, sometimes it's like that.
Like anything sometimes can happen, kind of thing.
Yeah, you're kind of putting yourself in a place where you know we're going to write some songs. That's what we put today aside for. Yeah. Monday's writing day or something, you know, like that. Sometimes it's like that in life. Other times, songs just need to get out of you. They're just inside of you and they just need to come out. And All My Friends is just one of those songs. I remember, so I used to drink whiskey. I was really, really, really bad at drinking straight spirits at the time. And it's really, I hate how tacky that is, that it's whiskey as well, of all things. I'm in Hollywood drinking whiskey, and that's a complete cliche. but it's too
important. But you're there partly for that, right? You want to make a rock and roll record. You want to, for better or worse, absorb and immerse yourself in that, dare I say it, romanticism.
But you want that silliness, don't you? The thing with Creeper as well, there's like a pomp and an over-the-top nature to it. So like, if you go into Hollywood to make a record, it seemed like it almost like a joke to us because we were like, of course Creeper. But if we were fans of Creeper, it would make sense to us. Of course Creeper would make a record in Hollywood next. That would be the next logical progression, you know? Like that's the silly thing that they would do. So we're trying to play on that a little bit. But so one night I was up in the studio, and it's a wonderful place called Wax. Wax Studios up on Sunset. It is. It used to have Jimi Hendrix there. The Doors recorded records there. It's a wonderful little studio. The studio A and Studio B. All red lights everywhere, all the time. And I would stay there till late. I'd start drinking early and stay there late.
Is it just you and the producer?
It was me. Hannah was there too. Yep. For some of it. And Redder, his assistant, and Zandy and myself. So we would finish writing or recording something, and I would, while he would be like sorting it all out and popping all, you know, mixing and doing bits. I hate all that stuff. This is not who I am.
You want to let it down and then get out.
I say this all the time. Just, that's not my strong suit. I didn't get into music for science. But I understand the importance of that science. My brain just doesn't work like that. It's just so difficult for me to stay interested. I always duck out at that point. So what I would do is I would sit in the live room while he would mix in the control room, and there's a lovely upright piano there, and I would just sit there and play that. And it's one day, and by the time we got to that sort of hour, I was always drunk, but this one day I was super drunk, and just been drinking this whiskey straight all day. It was like a bottle a day, though. It was mental. It was so stupid.
What kind of whiskey were you drinking?
I drink scotch.
Okay.
It was weird. I would sit there and drink that and just kind of play at this piano. And this song, I would just write things. I write things all the time, you know, but most of the time it's for nothing. You know, unless it's like, like we said before, we're doing a writing day. So this song fell out of me as I was doing it, and Zandy came in and said, "Oh man, that's a really lovely song." And I was like, "Oh, I don't want to use that. I don't want to use it." I was drunk as well, and he was like, "Oh, would you just record it? Like, I'll set a mic up and just record a little scratch of it." And I was like, "Oh, I don't know." So go on. So we did it, and the next day Hannah heard it, and then it ended up being that thing that like, I was just writing like a really honest thing with my friends, and often it's easier for me to write in lyric and melody and then to sit down and talk to somebody about it, you know. Like the song kind of spilled out of me this one evening, and I didn't want to put it on. I felt like it was too real. I didn't think it didn't fit in with our narrative at all, or anything else on the record, and I felt like we were giving people too much of a dose of what actually had happened. But everybody persuaded me in the end, including Ian. So it's difficult for both of us to listen to that. I often compare it to, this has been my favorite comparison to it. It's a really weird one as well, so stay with me here.
I'm with you.
So are you familiar with the theme park, Universal Studios in Hollywood, California?
I've never been, no. I've been to Hollywood many times, but never the studio theme park.
Okay, there was this ride there that was there's a Jurassic Park ride. It's a log flume.
Uh-huh.
And what it is it was made by Steven Spielberg himself. He helped make the ride. They actually had the idea for the ride before they had to put the film out. And it cost more than the film to make. It's true. It's madness, isn't it? So anyway, like this log flume, it goes around and there's all these different dinosaurs. You go through Jurassic Park and then things go wrong and you get knocked off course and you go up a hill into the building. And at the end, a big T-Rex pops out, and it's an animatronic T-Rex, and you go towards him, and then just before you reach him, you drop down, and you get a nice shoot, and you splash at the bottom, and that's kind of how it works. So, Steven Spielberg helped make this thing, and to this day, when he rides that ride, he sits on the log of the boats and goes round and round and round, and then it goes up the hill and gets up to the T-Rex, and when the T-Rex pops out, he has to stop the ride, and he gets off because he can't take the final drop. And he is too scared. He goes down the stairs instead of taking the drop, the splashdown. And I feel like that with this record, which is a really weird analogy, but I built this thing. I care about it a lot. I put a lot of my life into it, and I love it very, very dearly. But I just had to get off before the final drop. That last drop is just too scary for me. Even though I know it's coming, even though I put it there, I still can't do it. I still have to turn it off before we get to that point.
Will you play it live?
We spoke about this the other day. I'm really not sure how we're going to, but I guess we're going to have to at some point. But it's going to be a really difficult one for us, that one in particular.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
How was the experience of being out in LA on your own? Because I know LA very well, and I'm lucky to have a lot of friends who live there. So I've always been shown around and taken in. But I'm also aware that LA, a lot like London, but way more so, can be a super lonely place for, like, especially an Englishman who's going through what you were going through. And, you know, there's the pressure on to create this follow-up, and it should have been this amazing, magical experience, and yet you're there alone. Like, how was that period for you on a personal level, just when you're not in the studio? What was going through your mind?
Well, it was super bizarre. I had a really insane experiences in Los Angeles. I went to the Magic Castle.
Yeah, yeah.
I ended up at people's mansions just randomly, on nights out. I ended up in weird after hours kind of fetish clubs downtown and warehouses. I ended up at lots of strange situations in that city because people have a really skewed version of what Hollywood is. When people first come out, most of the time you visit as a tourist, and the first time I went as a tourist, and when you first go there, most people go, I went to Hollywood, and it was just really dirty. It wasn't what I expected at all. I didn't like it.
Everybody has that disappointment, don't they? Because their expectations are like that it's going to be all glitz and glamour, and actually downtown Hollywood is pretty grimy.
And it's the thing, but like, I love all that sort of thing. So
yeah, man.
I've always been this is exactly what I wanted. I wasn't expecting anything else. You know, you don't go to Big Ben and expect to meet the Queen, you know? I was just like, you know, I'm not expecting to meet movie stars outside the Chinese theater, you know, that's not, but even though you can do it if you go to a premiere there. I walked past many premieres, which is funny and weird.
Did you go to the Frolic Room, Will? That's my favorite spot.
No, I didn't go to the Frolic Room.
Old dive bar, like where Bukowski used to drink, just a thin, long, narrow room, happy hours, like $2 a beer. And it's just one of those like old Hollywood places that just feels like it's stuck, you know, in this time capsule, and it hasn't been updated by the outside world. It's amazing. But all those kind of like old, and there isn't many with every cities, everything gets gentrified and updated. But places like that for me in Hollywood still have that
magic
about them.
Yeah, well, I went to Musso and Frank's.
I was going to say, of course, yeah, that's the oldest restaurant, yeah? I've eaten there, loved it.
Yeah, and well, Orson Welles, obviously famously used to eat there and drink there. It's a weird place because I'm a vegan, and so a vegan at a steakhouse, basically.
Yeah.
So I had an avocado and chips.
I'll just have the bread option, no butter. Yeah.
I mean, that's what it used to be like being vegan over here for years. Things are well different now, but it's just funny. Those older spots, the traditional spots like that, they are, things are a little bit old fashioned. It's kind of nice in a weird way. Got some lovely drinks there, but yes, like I used to go to all different sorts of places. Obviously, I spend nights at the Whiskey and the Rainbow and all those sorts of places that you have to go to because you're in Hollywood.
Yeah.
But
were you in a happy spot, or were you just in a strange, dark, dreamlike spot? What was going on?
It was just weird. Like I was running away from my problems at home, and I was drinking to escape, and I was making a record about escapism while I was escaping in the most fantastical place. You know, if you want to find trouble in Los Angeles, or if you want to find, the infinite void, you can find it. It exists around everywhere. And it's funny because it's just below the surface of Hollywood. There is just below in the water, just below, lying beneath. There's a real sinister edge.
Yes.
And a real kind of vacuum. And you don't see it the first few times you go there. You might think it's dirty, but you don't really notice the true that true spot. But what I came to realize, I used to go to a lot of goth clubs and things when I was up there as well. I used to go drink at a lot of different cool bars. We used to go to No Vacancy, if you've ever been there.
No.
I used to drink drinking lots of places. But what I realized at one point, I was like, what was strange at first was everyone there is an actor or a musician or, you know, kind of, or a failed actor or a failed musician.
Yeah, or a waiter.
Somebody trying to pitch a TV show in a cab to you. They realize they're driving you to a recording studio, and then they realize they're asking who else you know, and you know. And so that's, and then you end up these weird parties where everyone's kind of just sucking each other's dicks and things. And it's horrible. I hate all that stuff. But like, what I realized, the people I really, really loved were, I realized that very few of them were actually from Hollywood. They just ended up at Hollywood. Mm-hmm. These people, like the people wash up in the place like Hollywood and land there because they chased a dream, or they're a little bit weird and different to the people from the state they were from. And they wanted to go do something else. They saw an opportunity. So there's a weird hopefulness amongst the kind of
desperation
the weirdos. Yeah, it's kind of the weirdos. And when I realized, holy shit, I'm also one of these weirdos. I fit in here better than I fit in at home. Like this is why I love this so much, because all my friends I've made here, I'm exactly the same as them. Like we're all here for exactly the same reasons. Not because we're necessarily chasing a dream, but because we didn't fit in anywhere else. And so it's no accident that we've all ended up here talking. And so my experience went from a very, very dark place. It was definitely some extremely dark times for me in Hollywood. But by the end of it, much like in the story of our record, the redemption story at the end of it, of the narrative, I kind of, when I left, I remember everybody coming out with me for my last night in Hollywood, and it being this massive blowout, and people just didn't want me to leave, and it was so nice. I had this lovely, cool group of friends I kind of made over this time, and I loved it, and I loved them, and I just realized that I kind of fit in there. I fit in there definitely better than I did back at home. And it was they really helped me to escape from my problems for a little while as well. So yeah, it was a really strange experience.
It gets a bad rep, but I love Los Angeles. I've been treated like absolute gold every time I've been there. And every time I've been there, like you, by the end of the trip, I just think, oh, I wish this wasn't over. I wish I could stay. I feel a lot more at place here, if only I could stay. Like people there, although there's sometimes a motive, and you know, that's just the way of the world sometimes, but for the large part, everybody that I've encountered and connected with over there has been genuine in their affection and in their warmth and hospitality and generosity. And I've just had such amazing experiences over there. And it's just, as you say, full of unpredictable, wild wonder, if you want that.
Yeah, I think I completely agree with you there. I think that's completely true. I think I think you have to know what you're getting yourself in for. You can go to the Chinese theater and go see the Hollywood sign, and then you know go to a theme park and go home. There is definitely that's a really nice thing to do there. It's really, really fun. I love theme parks. It's one of my favorite things in the world, and I love all those things that I've listed. Like that David Bowie's star is just around the corner from the Chinese theater. It was really cool for me, but if you're looking for something else, I almost guarantee that Hollywood can give that to you. That there'll be somebody at whatever hour. even though the bars close at 2 a.m.
It's weird, isn't it? The whole city just goes on lockdown around 1, 2, yeah. And you're like, oh, where to next? And then that's where you end up at these weird houses in the hills. And
yeah, that's the thing. It's funny. There's that Grand Theft Auto game that's based around Los Angeles. And it's funny how, like, I remember seeing that game after I'd been spending my time there, and I was like, this is literally like where I was hanging out, like, but like they built this in the video game, and like going up to the hills, it's really funny, like you end up it's funny the class divide between the super ultra wealthy there and people living on the streets. They have a massive homeless problem, obviously, in Hollywood. They have for years now. It's really, really bad. It's just horrible. It's heartbreaking every time you walk by. But that is a mad thing in itself. You know, there's such a mixture of things going on everywhere, and it's kind of the disparity between people. God, it's a fascinating place. Like, I'm really looking forward to returning as a non-work capacity and a non-ultra stress capacity as well.
I feel you. I've written a book during lockdown, which is being put out by an LA-based publishing company, and my hope, my dream, was to go out there when the book comes out in September and have a release party in the Viper Room. But obviously with COVID,
and
Viper Room's so good. My friend Jeff books all the bands there, and I've always kind of gone there as my first port of call whenever I land. And yeah, I was like, I'll do a fucking book launch in a rock club, do things a bit differently. But obviously for now, you know, my feet are going to be firmly grounded in the UK. I want to ask you a couple of more things, Will, because I want to let you get off soon and, you know, enjoy the rest of your day and stuff and celebrate without me grilling you. But what I wanted to ask is, you know, you've obviously kind of taken a lot of time away from the public eye by today's standards. Back in the day, this would have been normal. But nowadays, you know, you need to be omnipresent all the time, seem to be doing stuff to kind of hold people's attention because of the nature of the world that we're supposedly in. But you've obviously shown that you can go away and retire and come back and reinvent and stuff. But what were the record label side of the creeper camp saying, and how were they reacting whilst your, you know, crazy ideas to kill off the band, have a media blackout, do all of that? What was their response to all of that? Were they supportive? Were they confused? Were they discouraging? Were they encouraging?
God bless them. They're a very supportive bunch. They really are. But every time I dump something on them, takes them a little minute to kind of get with it. Because I think the thing is, I think this is why I like working with them so much as well. Because eventually they get really, really excited. And they tell me that a lot of the time when they're signing people, bands just get signed, and then they expect the record label to do everything for them and market them and do all this other stuff. And I think they like working with us because I don't want them to do any of that stuff. In fact, I want to do all of it because I've done it. Like, I did it in my old band, and I worked in, you know, DIY punk like my whole life before that. So yeah, I want to make it myself. And but they do freak out. I remember telling them about killing the band off, and them all being very concerned about that. I went to several different meetings where we spoke about the wording of what I would say on stage. And in the end, I said, oh, you know, David Bowie did this. He was on Parlophone when he did it, I believe. And that's the office for that is downstairs.
So amazing.
That happened in this building. Come on. Like, if you did this back in the 70s, you know, with a much more prolific act and a bigger act at the time, you could let me do it with our band. And so they agreed to let me do we agreed on it together. I could do it, but only if I use a very similar quote to the Bowie thing, so there could be some speculation around it. So that's what we went for. But like, all these things are a nightmare to pull off. They're all just it's never like I remember with the first time we went missing, they were like, when we were doing this thing going into the album, the last one,
I remember that. Yeah, God, I remember that.
Yeah, it was in reference to the Blair Witch Project, the whole thing. But if you've ever been interested in the way that was marketed, it's fascinating.
That film was a genius. Pre-social media, the marketing of that movie was groundbreaking. Yeah.
Yeah, it was viral before viral was a thing.
Yep.
It was really, really fascinating. So we based a lot of our marketing ideas for that record around the marketing of that film. So I was like, well, look, what we need to do is to delete all the banned social media. Like, people won't believe we've gone missing unless we delete all of the posts. They will have to go. They will have to go. And I remember them going, oh, we've spent like 3 years building all this stuff up, guys. Like, all the stats, all the likes and the photos, anything a booking agent would see about a tour poster, who you toured with in the past. And I was like, no, it has to go. We have to delete it. No one's going to believe it if we don't delete it all. They're like, yeah, think about it. Why don't we just deactivate them for a while? I was like, no, they'll have to be deleted.
It's all or nothing.
So, yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Like, I feel like often in life with these things, with creative stuff, it's the little things that make the big things happen.
Yeah, man.
And you don't believe the whole piece if there is a small piece out of place. So you have to... So in the end, what I just did is I just went through Instagram and deleted every single picture myself by hand. So it had to be done, all the Facebook stuff. So it was a proper wipe. So people had to activate and had to look into it. And I remember the Daily Echo in Southampton where we were from covered it like it was a real news story.
Brilliant.
That we'd gone missing. And the thing is, I don't think they would have done that. If it was visibly a marketing thing, people wouldn't have believed in it, you know? And the reason that people's suspension of disbelief was there was because it's half real, half fake. It's professional wrestling, isn't it? Again, it's what's real, what's fake, which part is real. I know this is fake, but that bit looked real. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
That's a sleight of hand with all this stuff. So a lot of the time when I'm coming to them with it, there are moments where it's like, oh.
What's he going to come up with next?
Like, yeah, and I mean, I'm already back on my bullshit with this stuff. but it's fun, and I think that the last show one was that's not one of my favorite ones things we've done. I remember actually this tour we did in 2017 where I was telling them what I wanted to do, which was a Southampton World Fair, like it's interrupted. So I wanted to promote the tour like it was a World Fair, like a fictional World Fair from Southampton that was touring around, because all of our characters in the last record were myths we based around Southampton, like there was a sleep demon and you know, the Caliph Heart gang, this ghost gang, all these kind of myths we embedded into Southampton. And so I wanted this a Southampton theme that was kind of interrupted. So I remember putting this all together. We had this mask. There was a kabuki in front of the mask at the rear of the stage that had a print on it for a Southampton World's Fair. And we made a theme song for the World's Fair. It was like kind of like the Walt Disney kind of... When he did the World's Fair, the New York World's Fair, and they had the Carousel of Progress, and so they had this, it's a great big beautiful tomorrow shining at the end of every day, you know those kind of real upbeat 50s things.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
We had our own one called Shaking Hands with the Stranger of Tomorrow that we recorded, and we played at the beginning, and then the show was interrupted and the kabuki dropped, and there was this giant mask that was like 20 foot and it was made of steel, and it had lasers that came out of his eyes, and I remember pitching that, what I've just told you there. And he says, this is what we're going to do for the tour. And then everyone's just like,
jaws to the floor, speechless.
Well, it's cool because they get, well, and when they see it, they're so excited when it happens and everyone is. But I think at the beginning, I mean, we overspent on that tour massively. It was crazy, to be honest with you. But it was really, it was a spectacle. And I think that's what we're missing so often. And that's why we love bands, especially in this country. Like we love bands like Ghost. And people who do things a little bit more at the top with a pomp and a ridiculousness.
Yeah.
I mean, we gave the world Black Sabbath, for God's sake, you know? Iron Maiden, you know? Like, we're from a country that loves the grandiose. That's why we have this fascination with America all the time, because when they started doing that stuff as well, it did so amazingly well.
The grandiose and the pomp is obviously there in spades and a big part of what you do. What I also love is I remember for me, so growing up pre-internet, you know, you'd get into bands and all you could find out about them was what was in the latest music magazine or, you know, what was in the liner notes to the albums. And a band that to this day remain one of my favorite has always been NOFX, because every one of their albums, although it wasn't theatrical in any way, it was very comical and they'd always make up just absurd stories and lies. So you'd never really know who the band was, who's in the band. And you couldn't just go online and look it up. And it always encouraged me more to try and find out more about this little universe of theirs. chairs and be inquisitive. And that mystery is what drives the interest and the passion. And I think so many bands now are just like, this is who we are. Here's our online profile. This is the music. It's all there. There's no secrets. There's nothing to hide. And, you know, I think people want that mystery. They want something to confuse them a little bit and provoke them. And do you know what I mean? And that's obviously what you guys are all about in every element of your presentation of the band.
I think that is a really cool thing what you said about NoFX. I think that's really, really true. The singer is Eric Nally from Foxy Shazam, if you know that band.
I love that band so much. So that self-titled album by them is one of the best albums of the last 15 years. It's amazing.
Honestly, it's a tragedy that band's not the biggest band in the world.
Absolutely, I know.
Fantastic band. But he is an amazing man. But he used to make lies up about himself. You know, Bob Dylan used to do the same thing. He used to tell the press that he was raised in the circus.
Of course.
I hate the way other bands do things these days. I look at it and I just think it sucks. If I'm honest with you,
yeah.
I hate the way people treat their bands these days. I think a lot of the time, it's boring. It is safe. I think it's safe, but people are standing up for causes, but it kind of just like, I don't know. It just doesn't seem very very sincere when they're talking. Sometimes they're playing like, you know, I'm playing a character of an angel that's fallen from heaven and that falls in love with a girl that's going to get shot at the end of our show. And that's what I'm doing. You know, that's ridiculous because it is.
Yeah.
But like, I feel like these other people, other singers in bands play a character as well. I'm just telling you I'm playing a character. They don't tell you they're playing a character, and they play the role of singer. You know,
yeah.
So what they post has to be like, that fall in line with someone who's got a platform. So you just get the same, everyone posts the same things over and over again. I always feel like in a sea of bands shouting at you to listen to their records, the best thing you can do is to shut up, you know, like,
and let the music do the talking, right?
Well, yeah, like this, I don't know. That's what the whole idea of those silences, and you know, the whole idea of that Fugitives of Heaven show last year was that, like, wouldn't it be cool if we took a year off, and after our year off, we put a show on sale that didn't say it was creeper anywhere, and see if people were so stoked, even after a year of silence. And in the time we've been gone, people just been shouting about their records nonstop. Wouldn't it be cool if that worked out? And it did. I don't know. I don't think we're doing anything groundbreaking. I think we take a lot of cues from bands like AFI, in terms of marketing, like when they did Sing the Sorrow, an elaborate campaign with telephone numbers that you'd call and you'd ring through and you'd do different bits and pieces. And we've been from, as I said, Blair Witch Project was a big one for us. We're taking it from a lot of different places. But like you said, I just don't think that stuff exists. That's why it seems fresh to people when we do it, because no one does it anymore. I don't know. People just do disappointing things on the internet, and it's not even disappointing as in like they've done bad things.
Yeah, just
it's boring things. Yeah, you know who's really good at this? There's a band called Static Dress. They've got their shit dialed in, and they know exactly what they're doing. In terms of their content, in terms of the way they roll things out, and how it looks, the attention to detail.
What
amazing
do you reckon to Twin Temple? I bet you're a fan of them, aren't you?
I saw them play, actually. I saw them play here in Manchester. I saw them at the Deaf Institute.
They've got a really good aesthetic going on, haven't they?
Oh, it's amazing. You know, it just ticks so many boxes for me because it's doo-wop, but I love Phil Spector. You know, I'm not as a man. He's an evil man. But
yeah.
In terms of his work, I'm a massive Phil Spector fan. So it's like that sound coupled with some sort of Satanic temple, chic, you know, and it just looks amazing. And they're just a fantastic band. I'd love to do some shows with them at some point. We follow each other on the internet.
That's a tour that is waiting to happen.
Yeah, I think we should do that. I think it'll be really, really good. I think maybe that'll be the next thing we do, something like that. We follow each other on the internet, and we've had some back and forth online, which is cool. But it's just rad. It's that attention to detail, you know, and it's that larger than life thing that we miss so much, you know. I remember going to gigs when I was younger, and you couldn't believe the band was going to be on the stage soon. You know, it was like, oh my god, I wonder what backstage is like. But
the way social media
has ruined everything. Now you know what backstage is like. It's a bunch of people sat around on their laptops.
Yeah, not talking to each other, checking Instagram.
There is a singer doing a very slow skit to warm up his legs to run around the stage, and you know, sipping a Dr. Vox tea as he warms his voice up slowly with the Melissa Cross warm up. That is exactly what the backstage room is like. And yeah, you know, man. That now the whole thing's been lifted, you know. But I don't know. I remember going to see Alkaline Trio when I was a kid, and it's been like, holy shit, like the band are going to be on the stage in a second. This is nice. Which way are they going to come on from? Getting excited about that stuff. I think we have a duty to protect that for younger people. I think that's a magic and there's a sorcery to that we're somehow losing, and that, I think that's quite sad. But bands like Twin Temple absolutely do that, you know. It's the thing. That's why ghosts are cool. It's why it's kind of larger than life characters. That's you know, I keep talking about professional wrestling in this conversation. I don't know why, but I'm desperate to get in for some reason. I don't know why. But yeah, The Undertaker, that's why his character like lasted so long and had such a fruitful career. Because people want to see spectacle. People want to lose themselves. Not all the time, you know. But I get the need for why grunge happened in the first place. Because we went a little bit too far the way me and you were talking.
Yeah,
you know,
maybe
with hair metal and stuff, and Guns N' Roses and things. Maybe I love Guns N' Roses, but like maybe at that the culture had gone a little bit too far that way and needed Kurt Cobain and stuff, you know. But like I do think that there's a gap right now, and it needs filling with something really, really magical. And we should try and give that to people as best we can, I think. And that's what we're trying to do all the time anyway.
Well, dude, you're succeeding in it, man. And again, to throw back to the first interview that we did a few years back, it was just before, I think, the debut album came out. And I was saying to the director on Scurs, I was like, this tune reminds me so much of Meatloaf. And he was like, Meatloaf? He's like, you better not tell him that in the interview. I was like, what do you mean? I was like, can you not hear that influence? And he was like, no, you're mad. And then I obviously mentioned it in the interview, and you and both you and Ian's eyes lit up, and you were like, we love Jim Steinman, we love Meatloaf. And so even then I was like, these guys are different. They're doing something different. They're drawing from different areas. And what I love about this new album, to kind of like wrap it up and bring it home, is there's so much on there. You've mentioned Bowie a few times, and there's obviously a lot of 70s glam in there. There's, for me, a lot of like 80s era Bruce Springsteen and that kind of stuff.
Absolutely.
And then the more palatable end of Tom Waits. And then there's like, you know, obviously the Britpop stuff is massively there as well, with the Manic Street Preachers and Suede. And you do all of these different things and you absorb all of these different sounds, but it's still under the umbrella of Creeper. And everything sounds like you guys, but just enriched with this vast array of incredible influences. And you've made just an amazing record, dude. And you should be very, very proud. The one song I'd like to end on, because I want to play out with it, Poisoned Heart. Tell me about that tune. That's my jam, I think.
Oh, man. Well, thank you, firstly, for saying all those lovely things. That's very sweet. And it's cool that you put those references out. It's you know, you never know. When you're doing something like this, it is such an eclectic mix of different stuff that's kind of like a hot pot, you know, like one of those like those electric hot pots. You kind of throw all this stuff in and it's similar together. And it's cool when people notice that, like that. So that means a lot to me. Thanks, man. And so in terms of Poison Heart, we wrote this song. I was at the piano and Ian was on acoustic guitar, and we were sat listening live in Los Angeles. That one was written before Ian's Ian's mental health situation got too bad. And it came out, I was originally singing it in the octave above. I wasn't doing the baritone yet. But right. I've been desperate to do the baritone for ages.
Chris Isaac style.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it was kind of the Leonard Cohen fan in me, and Nick Cave, and I just loved all that stuff growing up, and so I was been desperate to do it for ages. But everyone, it's funny now, because like today, everyone's been so lovely about the record. But I remember for ages, everyone going, "Well, this doesn't really sound like Creeper," and I was like, "You know, but that's the whole point."
yeah. We say what sounds like Creeper, not you. Do you know what I mean?
Exactly. But like, it was cool in the end. Like they love it. This one is it's Phoebe's favorite song. I don't know if you know Phoebe Sinclair.
Yes, she dates. She's married to my dear friend Aria. So yeah, I was at their wedding,
yeah,
and I know Phoebe very well.
Yes, she's a wonderful, wonderful woman. This is her favorite one from the record. She always She's so funny. I love her to bits. She's actually one of the people that have been, I think, the biggest aid in our career. She's been a supporter and a believer of it the entire time.
Poison Heart. Shout out Phoebe.
Shout out Phoebe, 100%. So this song, so I was singing The Octave Above, and we started tracking it, and we got some, kind of at the time, it was a demo we first did, and it had like some vintage kind of drum sounds on it and things, and acoustic guitar and piano and stuff. And I was singing it The Octave Above, and so then what we did, I was like, oh, you know what, I reckon I can do a cool thing. And then I went in, and I started singing it in the baritone, and we were all laughing at first. We were like, is this too far? Are we going too far? It's like the sweet spot with Creepo. It's always...
Where's the line? Yeah,
just before it goes silly. Like just before, you know, and you don't want it to be serious because serious is dull, you know, but you want people to take the ridiculous seriously. Does that make sense?
Of course, like, you've got Foxy Shazam as your kind of yardstick. It's ridiculous, 100%. But it's not comedy.
Yeah, well, think about, like, and what's the last song on Batten Out of Hell? For Crying Out Loud, you know?
Yeah.
And can't you see my faded Levi's busting apart? You know, like, this is a ridiculous lyric. Like, this is, you know, it's a ridiculous song. And it's so over the top, but he sings it. And he toes the line perfectly in that performance. Where you feel emotionally, you feel moved by it. There's strings on this ridiculously epic song. And that's the place you want to get to. So, I did this baritone. We're all laughing, and Daniel, like, this is fucking great. We have to go this way. This is where we have to go. And Ian was like, yeah, dude, yeah. And so then, I felt like I carried on the chorus in the same place I was singing it originally, but we just lowered, like I just lowered the into the baritone. But it took a while to learn that baritone too, you know, because it's a different sort of control you have to have, and to do it, it's a completely different way of singing, really. So it took me a little minute to kind of get to dial it in for the rest of the songs that we did with the baritone too. But it's been funny. So yeah, that one's like a really, it's one of my favorite ones as well, because it's just a simple song.
Yes. Yeah.
It's you know.
Yeah, it's not musically complex at all, but it just hits you in that sweet spot.
Yeah, well, it's more about the arrangement and the strings and things that that kind of aid it, I think, rather than like the actual the chords are playing, you know. As typically is with lots of this stuff, but there's not even much of a bridge to the song, you know. There's not a vocal in the bridge, you know. Like it didn't warrant it. And a lot of time, I think, in my experience, and from my point of view, it's about serving the song and what goes into the song. So what goes into the song is like when's it acceptable for a drummer to do a drum solo? You know, like, yeah. Do you want a drummer that is just constantly over drums the entire time? No, you don't. Sometimes you want someone to play a straight beat. Do you want a singer who has to sing over every single part of the song? No, you don't. Like, that's annoying as well. You know, like, do you want a guitar player who's going to want to put solos everywhere, harmonize every? You just don't. Like, I guess the way I like to approach songwriting is what best fits the song. And this song, it just fit better for me not to sing on that bridge and just to leave it to a piano. So, lyrically, it's quite sparse. There's like two verses and a chorus, and that's it. And but yeah, it's cool. Like that's I think that's the magic sometimes, you know, when it's just right, you know. I don't know.
I'm trying to figure out now: is there a horn coming from your end or mine? That's my end. This you know, it's Friday in Walthamstow in London when all the fucking horns start up. Well, on that rude note. I think they're stopping now. Will, thank you so much for just a really, really great chat, man, and genuinely a magic piece of work and a great album. And it sounds like everything has gone into it, blood, sweat, heart, tears, the lot. I'm sure you've got plenty more tricks up your sleeve when it comes to the live presentation of all this stuff too.
Yes, mate, absolutely. It's like, honestly, Matt, I like hearing you talk about it and stuff as well, that's got me so stoked, man. I appreciate you putting out the things you have, and the live shows are going to absolutely be a spectacle as well. It's just, I want it to be a feeling of like when the band comes through town, you can't miss it. I want it to be something special every single time. I don't want it just to be just another band. It's not even really a band. I want it to be an experience you go to and something you can lose yourself in.
It's like the Bob Dylan Rolling Thunder review, isn't it? It's a happening. It's an event. Every night's different. You don't know what you're going to get.
Exactly. Well, that's cool thing about this stuff, and the thing is, I think what we're trying to drill into people is especially with some of the recent things we did in the last few years, the breakup of the band, that sense of finality, you know, like there's an absolute, like if you don't come to this thing, if you don't get to come to the show, you'll never get to see it.
Yeah, that's it. It only happens once. It's in the moment. Yeah. If you're not there, you miss the moment. I get that completely.
And that's the thing. That's why we won't never wear those jackets again, the Calatrava jackets. Because we want to time lock that period of time. And so now if you see a photo of us wearing those jackets, you know exactly when that was from. You know, that's exactly, it time locks it. Nothing messes up with that. You're not going to see me at 50 years old wearing a Calatrava patch and ruining that period of time, you know? I think that's a good spot to leave it. Much in the same way you wouldn't want to see David Bowie at 50 wearing Ziggy Stardust makeup, you know? Like, this is the whole idea, isn't it? You know, so you've got to come out to these shows because it's going to be a spectacle, and you won't see that ever again because we'll have moved on by the next time something comes, you know? And there'll be the next thing. So I don't know. That's kind of our mantra. It's trying to make sure we're creating something special each time around, and something that is like a once in a lifetime thing. You can only see it this one time, and then it's gone. Does that make sense?
Absolutely, mate. I 100% hear everything you've been saying. And may I say that you are a lovely man as well as a talented man, Will. And any friend of Jack's is a good friend of mine as well.
Man, I'd love to have you as well, man. Thank you so much for doing this on release day as well. It's pretty cool.
It's really cool, isn't it? I don't think I've ever done a podcast on release day before. And it gives it a nice special lean because it's like you're obviously in the headspace of talking about it, but it's now out, so there's also that kind of element of I don't own this anymore. It's now public property, so here are my thoughts, but then, you know, this isn't verbatim, this isn't the whole truth, because now it's up to everybody else to make up their mind, isn't it? And what an exciting day, and what a beautiful day as well. Get the swim shorts on, mate.
I mean, I have to. It's absolutely roasting here.
It's fucking so hot. I went for a walk earlier and I was just drenched by the time I got home. I was like, right, I'm doing the interview in shorts. I went out in fucking trousers, stupidly, but never again. Listen, mate, I hope you have a great weekend. And
You too, man.
See you soon, dude.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Me, I've got a poisoned heart. Right from the start, I have deceived you, and you stay away from me. Cougar kills in dreams, I'll steal them from you. In the dark, I'll creep to your heart. Poison tune. Drown with me, darling, drown with me. I'll take you to the edge of everything. Burn with me, darling, burn with me. I'll take you to the edge of
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Spin your passion into a business with Shopify and break sales records with the world's best converting checkout. Let's hear that one more time. The world's best converting checkout. Shopify's legendary checkout makes it easier for customers to shop on your website, across social media, and everywhere in between. Now that's music to your ears. Any way you spin it, you can be a smash hit with Shopify. Start your $1 a month trial today at shopify.com/records.